A fact of nature that we humans, vainly or disingenuously, pretend our codes of civilization transcend. From his garden, Hikmet can see down to the harbor at Kyrenia, guarded by a 7th-century Byzantine castle built atop Roman fortifications that preceded it. Crusaders and Venetians subsequently took it, then came Ottomans, then British, and now Turks were having a turn again. Today a museum, the castle holds one of the world's rarest relics, a complete Greek merchant ship discovered in 1965, scuttled a mile off of Kyrenia. When it went down, its hold was filled with millstones and hundreds of ceramic urns containing wine, olives, and almonds. Its cargo was heavy enough to mire it where currents buried it in mud. Carbon dating of the almonds it carried, likely picked in Cyprus only days earlier, shows that it sank about 2,300 years ago. Shielded from oxygen, the ship's Aleppo pine hull and timbers remained intact, although they had to be injected with polyethylene resins to keep from disintegrating once exposed to air. The boatbuilders had used nails of copper, also once plentiful on Cyprus, also impervious to rust. Equally well-preserved are lead fishing weights and the ceramic urns whose varied styles reveal the Aegean ports of their origin. The 10-foot-thick walls and curved towers of the castle where the ship is now displayed are of limestone quarried from the surrounding cliffs, bearing tiny fossils deposited when Cyprus was beneath the Mediterranean. Since the island was divided, however, the castle and the fine old stone carib warehouses of Kyrenia's waterfront have all but disappeared behind unlovely infestations of casino hotels. Gambling and loose currency laws being among the limited economic options open to a pariah nation. Hikmet Ulican drives east along Cyprus's north coast, passing three more castles of native limestone rising from the jagged mountains that parallel the narrow road. Along the headlands and promontories overlooking the Topaz Mediterranean are remains of stone villages, some of them 6,000 years old. Until recently, their terraces, half-buried walls, and jetties were also visible. Since 2003, however, yet another foreign incursion has assaulted the island's profile. "The only consolation," mourns Ulican, "is that this one can't last." Not crusaders this time, but elderly British seeking the warmest retirement a middle-class pension can buy, led by a frenzy of developers who discovered in the quasi-country of northern Cyprus the last cheap, untouched seafront property left anywhere north of Libya, with pliable zoning codes to match. Suddenly, bulldozers were scattering 500-year-old olive trees to scrape roads across hillsides. Waves of red-tiled roofs soon oscillated across the landscape, atop floor plans cloned repeatedly in poured concrete. Upon a tsunami of cash payoffs, property agents surfed to shore astride English-language billboards that appended terms like estates, hillside villas, seaside villas, and luxury villas to ancient Mediterranean place names. Prices from £40,000 to £100,000, $75,000 to $185,000 US, touched off a land rush that overwhelmed trifles such as title disputes by Greek Cypriots, who still claim to own much of the land. A Northern Cyprus Environmental Protection Trust vainly protested a new golf course by reminding people that they now had to import water from Turkey in giant vinyl bags, that municipal garbage tips were full, that the total lack of sewage treatment meant five times as much effluent would pour into the transparent sea. Each month, more steam shovels gobble coastline like famished brontosaurs, spitting out olive and carob trees along a widening blacktop now 30 miles east of Kyrenia, with no sign of stopping. The English language marches down the shore, dragging embarrassing architecture with it, one sign after another announcing the latest subdivision with a trust-inspiring British name, even as the seaside villas grow trashier. Concrete painted, not stuccoed. fake ceramic roof tiles made of tacky polymer, cornices and windows trimmed with faux-stenciled stonework. When Hikmet Ulaçan sees a pile of traditional yellow tiles lying in front of naked townhouse frames awaiting walls, he realizes that someone is ripping stone facing from local bridges and selling it to contractors. Something about these limestone squares lying at the base of skeletal buildings looks familiar. After a while, he figures it out. It is like Varosha. The half-finished buildings going up, surrounded by construction rubble, exactly recall the half-ruins of Varosha coming down. But if anything, quality has sunk even further. Each billboard touting Northern Cyprus's sunny new dream homes includes, near the bottom, notification of the construction guarantee. 10 years. Given rumors of developers not bothering to wash the sea salt from the beach sand they mine for concrete, 10 years may be all they get. Beyond the new golf course, the road finally narrows again. Past one-lane bridges stripped of their limestone ornaments, and a small canyon filled with myrtle and pink orchids, it enters the Karpaz Peninsula, the long tendril that reaches east toward the Levant. Along it are empty Greek churches, gutted but going nowhere, testaments to the tenacity of stone architecture. Stone structures were among the first things that distinguished sedentary humans from nomadic hunter-gatherers, whose temporary mud and wattle huts were no more permanent than the season's grass. Stone buildings will be among the last to disappear when we're gone. As the fleeting materials of modern construction decompose, the world will retrace our steps back to the Stone Age as it gradually erodes away all memory of us. As the road follows the peninsula, the landscape gets biblical, with old walls turning back to hills as gravity tugs on the underlying clay. The island ends in sand dunes covered by salt scrub and pistachio trees. The beach is smoothed by the belly tracks of mama sea turtles. A small limestone hill is topped by a lone branching umbrella pine. Shadows on the rock face turn out to be caves. Closer, the soft parabola of a low-arched portal reveals that it's been carved. At this wind-blown land's end, less than 40 miles across the water to Turkey, and only 20 miles more to Syria, the Stone Age began in Cyprus. Humans arrived around the same time that the oldest known building on Earth, a stone tower, was rising in the world's oldest city that is still inhabited, Jericho. However primitive this Cyprus dwelling is by comparison, it represented a momentous step, albeit one taken some 40,000 years earlier by Southeast Asians who reached Australia. Seafarers venturing beyond the horizon, out of sight of shore, and finding another one waiting. The cave is shallow, perhaps 20 feet deep, and surprisingly warm. A charcoal-smudged hearth, two benches, and sleeping niches were fashioned by cutting into the sedimentary walls. A second room, smaller than the first, is almost square, with a squared doorway arch. Remains of Australopithecus in South Africa suggest that we were cavemen at least 1 million years ago. In a river bluff grotto at Chauvet-Pont d'Arc in France, Cro-Magnons not only occupied caves 32,000 years ago, but also turned them into our first art galleries, depicting the European megafauna they sought, or whose strength they wished to channel. There are no such artifacts here. These first inhabitants of Cyprus were struggling pioneers, their time for aesthetic reflection still ahead. But their bones are buried beneath the floor. Long after all our buildings and what's left of the tower at Jericho are reduced to sand and soil, caves where we took shelter and first learned the notion of walls, including that they begged for art, will remain. In a world without us, they await the next occupant. Chapter 8. What Lasts. 1. Earth and Sky Tremors. It is hard to see exactly what holds up the enormous round dome of Istanbul's formerly Orthodox Christian, marble and mosaic-encrusted Church of Hagia Sophia. More than 100 feet across, it is slightly smaller than the dome that crowns Rome's Pantheon, but considerably higher. An inspired stroke of design divides its weight through a colonnade of arched windows at its base, making it appear to float. To gaze straight up at it, a gilded sky hovering 185 feet overhead, with no easy sense of why it stays aloft, leaves a beholder half believing in miracles and half dizzy. Over 1,000 years, the dome's weight has been further distributed among so many redoubled interior walls, additional half-domes, flying buttresses, pendentives, and massive corner piers, that Turkish civil engineer Mete Sözen believes that not even a major earthquake would easily shake it loose. That is exactly what happened to its first dome, which fell just 20 years after it was completed in AD 537. That mishap led to all the subsequent reinforcement. Even so, quakes severely damaged the church, which became a mosque in 1453, twice more, until Mimar Sinan, the greatest architect of the Ottoman Empire, restored it in the 16th century. The delicate minarets the Ottomans added to its exterior will one day topple, but even in a world without people, meaning no masons to periodically repoint the Hagia Sophia's mortar, Sözen expects much of it and other great ancient masonry edifices of Istanbul to last well into future geologic time, which is more than he can say, unfortunately, for the rest of the city of his birth. Not that it's quite the same city. Through history, Istanbul, nay Constantinople, nay Byzantium before that, has changed hands so many times that it's hard to imagine what could fundamentally alter it, let alone destroy it. But Mete Sözen is convinced that the former has already happened, and the latter is imminent, whether humans stick around or not. The only difference in a world without people is that no one would be left to try to pick up Istanbul's pieces. When Dr. Sözen, who holds a chair in structural engineering at Indiana's Purdue University, first left Turkey in 1952 for graduate studies in the United States, Istanbul had 1 million people. Half a century later, it has 15 million. He describes that as a far greater paradigm shift than its previous transformations from Delphic to Roman to Byzantine Orthodox to Crusader Catholic and finally to Muslim, in all its Ottoman and Turkish Republican strains. Dr. Sözen sees this difference through an engineer's eyes. Whereas all the previous conquering cultures erected fabulous monuments to themselves, like the Hagia Sophia and the nearby ethereal Blue Mosque, the architectural expression of today's hordes is manifest in more than 1 million multi-story buildings jammed into Istanbul's narrow streets. Buildings that, he says, are doomed to abbreviated lifespans. In 2005, Sözen and a team he assembled of international architectural and seismic experts warned the Turkish government that within 30 years, the North Anatolian Fault that runs just east of the city will slip again. When it does, at least 50,000 apartment buildings will fall. He's still awaiting a response, although he doubts that anyone can imagine where to begin to stave off what his expertise deems inevitable. In September 1985, the U.S. government rushed Sözen to Mexico City to analyze how its embassy had weathered an 8.1 magnitude earthquake that collapsed nearly 1,000 buildings. The highly reinforced embassy, which he had examined a year earlier, was intact. Up and down Avenida Reforma and adjacent streets, however, many high-rise offices, apartments, and hotels had disintegrated. It was one of the worst quakes in Latin American history. But it was mostly confined to downtown. What occurred in Mexico City is a flake of what will happen to Istanbul. One thing that the two disasters, past and future, have in common is that nearly all the buildings that crumbled or will crumble were built after World War II. Turkey stayed out of that war, but its economy took the same beating as every other country's. As industries recovered in the post-war European boom, thousands of peasants migrated to cities everywhere seeking jobs. Both the European and Asian sides of the Bosphorus Strait, which Istanbul straddles, filled with 6- and 7-story housing of reinforced concrete. But the quality of the concrete, Mete Sözen told the Turkish government, is 1/10 of what you'd find in, say, Chicago. Strength and quality of concrete depend on the amount of cement used. Back then, the problem was economics and availability. But as Istanbul's population grew, the problem did too, with more floors added to accommodate more humans. The success of a concrete or masonry building, Sözen explained, depends on how much you have to support above the first level. The more floors, the heavier the building. The danger comes when residential stories are stacked on top of structures whose ground floors are used for shops or restaurants. Most are open commercial spaces that lack internal columns or load-bearing walls, because they were never intended to support more than one story. Complicating matters further, floors added as afterthoughts rarely align in adjacent buildings, placing uneven stress on shared walls. Worse still, Sözen said, is when space is left at the top of a wall for ventilation or to save material. When a building sways during an earthquake, exposed columns in partial walls shear off. In Turkey, hundreds of schools have just such a design. Wherever air conditioning is unaffordable in the tropics, from the Caribbean to Latin America, to India to Indonesia, these extra spaces are especially common as a way to bleed off heat and invite breezes. In the developed world, the identical weakness is often found in structures without climate control, such as parking garages. In a 21st century, where more than half the human race lives in cities, and where most people are poor, cheap variations on the theme of reinforced concrete are repeated daily. Planet-wide piles of low bids that will come crashing down in a post-human world, and do so even faster if the city is near a fault line. When an earthquake strikes Istanbul, its narrow winding streets will clog so totally with the rubble of thousands of wrecked buildings, Sözen estimates, that much of the city will simply have to close down for 30 years before the massive destruction can be cleared away. Assuming there is anybody to do the clearing. If not, and if Istanbul remains a city where snow regularly falls in the winter, then freeze-thaw cycles will have plenty of earthquake detritus to reduce to sand and soil above the cobbles and pavement. Every earthquake causes fires. In the absence of response crews, the grand old wooden Ottoman mansions along the Bosphorus will contribute the ash of long-extinct cedars to the formation of new soil. Although mosque domes like the Hagia Sophia's will initially survive, the shaking will have loosened their masonry, and freeze-thaw will work at their mortar until bricks and stones start to fall. Eventually, as in 4,000-year-old Troy, 175 miles down Turkey's Aegean coast, only Istanbul's roofless temple walls will remain, still standing, but buried. 2. Terra Firma. Should Istanbul exist long enough to complete its planned subway system, including a line under the Bosphorus that would link Europe and Asia, since its tracks will cross no fault line, it will probably remain intact, albeit forgotten, long after the city on the surface is gone. Subways whose tunnels do encounter geologic faults, however, such as the San Francisco Bay Area's BART and New York City's MTA, may face another fate. In the Turkish capital of Ankara, the subway system's central nerve core broadens into an extensive underground shopping district with mosaic walls, acoustic ceilings, electronic billboard screens, and arcades of stores. An orderly underworld compared to the cacophony of the streets above. Ankara subsurface shops. Moscow subway, with its deep train tunnels and chandelier-lit museum-like underground stations, renowned as some of the most elegant spots in the city. Montreal's subterranean village of shops, malls, offices, apartments, and labyrinthine passages that reflect the city in miniature and link its old-fashioned surface structures. All these underground creations stand the best chance of any man-made edifice of lasting into whatever hereafter lies beyond human existence on Earth. Although seepage and surface cave-ins will eventually reach them, buildings still exposed to the elements will go well before structures that were born already buried. These won't be the oldest, however. 3 hours south of Ankara is a region of central Turkey whose name, Cappadocia, ostensibly means land of fine horses. But that has to be a mistake, the result possibly of some garbled pronunciation of a more fitting description in some ancient tongue. Because not even winged horses could steal the spotlight from this landscape, or from what lies beneath it. In 1963, a fresco, now thought to be the oldest landscape painting on Earth, was discovered in Turkey by University of London archaeologist James Mellert. Between 8,000 and 9,000 years old, it is also the oldest known work rendered on a surface constructed by humans. In this case, a mud-brick plastered wall. Overtly two-dimensional, the 8-foot mural is a flattened image of an erupting double-coned volcano. Out of context, its components make little sense. The volcano itself, painted with ochre pigments worked into wet lime plaster, could be mistaken for a bladder, or even two disembodied breasts. In this case, the teats of a female leopard, as they are curiously flecked with black spots. The volcano also seems to be perched directly atop a pile of boxes. From the vantage point of where it was discovered, however, its meaning is unmistakable. The double-barreled volcano shape matches the silhouette of 10,700-foot Hasan Dağ, 40 miles to the east, a long swoop of a mountain that hangs over central Turkey's high Konya plain. Together, the boxes form a primitive town plot of what many scholars consider the world's first city, Çatalhöyük, which is twice as old as the pyramids of Egypt, and with a population around 10,000, was far bigger than its contemporary, Jericho. All that remained of it when Mellert began digging was a low mound rising above wheat and barley fields. The first things he found were hundreds of obsidian points, which may explain the black spots, as the Hasan Dağ volcano was the source for that substance. But for reasons unknown, Çatalhöyük had been abandoned. The mud-brick walls of its house-sized boxes had fallen in on themselves, and erosion smoothed the rectangles of its skyline into a gentle parabola. Another 9,000 years, and the parabola should be long flattened. On Hasan Dağ's opposite slope, however, something quite different happened. What is now called Cappadocia began as a lake. During millions of years of frequent volcanic eruptions, its bowl filled with layers of ash that kept piling on, hundreds of feet deep. When the cauldron finally cooled, these congealed into tuff, a rock with remarkable properties. A huge final burst 2 million years ago unrolled a mantle of lava that left a thin crust of basalt atop 10,000 square miles of powdery gray tuff. When it hardened, so did the climate. Rain, wind, and snow set to work, with freeze-thaw cycles cracking and splitting the basalt pavement, and moisture seeping in to dissolve the tuff below. As it eroded, in places the ground collapsed. Left standing were hundreds of pale, slender pinnacles, each mushroom-capped with a hood of darker basalt. Tourism promoters call them fairy towers, a plausible descriptor, but not necessarily the first one that comes to mind. The magical version prevails, however, because the surrounding tough hills have invited not just wind and water to sculpt them, but also the hands of imaginative humans. Cappadocia's towns have not been built so much on the land as in it. Tough is soft enough that a determined prisoner here could scoop his way out of a dungeon with a spoon. When exposed to air, however, it hardens, forming a smooth, stucco-like shell. By 700 BC, humans with iron tools were burrowing into Cappadocia's escarpments, and even hollowing out fairy towers. Like a prairie dog village tipped on its side, every rock face was soon riddled with holes, some big enough for a pigeon, or a person, or a three-floor hotel. The pigeon holes, hundreds of thousands of arched niches hollowed into valley walls and pinnacles, were intended to attract rock doves, for exactly the same reasons humans in modern cities try to chase their urban cousins away: their copious droppings. So prized was pigeon guano, used here to nourish grapes, potatoes, and famously sweet apricots, that the carved exteriors of many dovecotes bear flourishes as ornate as those found on Cappadocia's cave churches. This architectural homage to a feathered fellow creature continued until artificial fertilizers reached here in the 1950s. Since then, Cappadocians no longer build them. Nor do they now build churches. Before the Ottomans converted Turkey to Islam, more than 700 were cut into Cappadocia's plateaus and mountainsides. Much of today's most expensive real estate here consists of luxury homes carved into tuff, with bas-relief exteriors as pretentious as the facades of mansions anywhere, and with mountainside views to match. Former churches have been recast into mosques. The muezzin call to evening devotion, resounding among Cappadocia's slick tuff walls and spires, is like a congregation of mountains praying. One distant day, these man-made caves, and even natural ones of stone much harder than volcanic tuff, will wear away. In Cappadocia, however, the stamp of humanity's passage will linger beyond our other traces, because here humans have not only ensconced themselves in plateau walls, but also beneath the plains, deep beneath. Should the Earth's poles shift, and sheet glaciers one day muscle their way across central Turkey, flattening whatever man-made structures still stand in their way, here they will only scratch our surface. No one knows how many underground cities lie beneath Cappadocia. 8 have been discovered, and many smaller villages, but there are doubtless more. The biggest, Derinkuyu, wasn't discovered until 1965, when a resident cleaning a back room of his cave house broke through a wall and discovered behind it a room that he'd never seen, which led to still another, and another. Eventually, spelunking archaeologists found a maze of connecting chambers that descended at least 18 stories and 280 feet beneath the surface, ample enough to hold 30,000 people, and much remains to be excavated. One tunnel, wide enough for 3 people walking abreast, connects to another underground town 6 miles away. Other passages suggest that at one time, all of Cappadocia, above and below the ground, was linked by a hidden network. Many still use the tunnels of this ancient subway as cellar storerooms. Unlike a river canyon, the earliest segments here are nearest the surface. Some believe the first builders were the Hittites of biblical times, who burrowed underground to hide from marauding Phrygians. Murat Urturul Gulyaz, an archaeologist at Cappadocia's Nevşehir Museum, agrees that Hittites lived here, but doubts they were the first. Gulyaz, a proud native with a mustache thick as a fine Turkish rug, worked on the excavation of Azikli Hüyük, a small Cappadocian mound containing the remains of a settlement even older than Çatalhöyük. Among the relics there were 10,000-year-old stone axes and obsidian tools capable of cutting tuff. "The underground cities are prehistoric," he declares. That, he says, explains the crudeness of the upper chambers, compared to the precision of the rectangular floors below. Later, everyone who appeared kept going deeper. It's as if they couldn't stop. one conquering culture after another realizing the benefit of a hidden subsurface world. The underground cities were lit by torches, or often, Guyas discovered, by linseed oil lamps, which also gave enough heat to keep temperatures pleasant. Temperature was probably what first inspired humans to dig them for winter shelter. But as successive waves of Hittites, Assyrians, Romans, Persians, Byzantines, Seljuk Turks, and Christians discovered these dens and warrens, they widened and deepened them for one principal reason: defense. The last two even expanded the original upper chambers enough to stable their horses underground. The smell of tuff that permeates Cappadocia, cool, clayish, with a menthol tang, intensifies below. Its versatile nature allowed niches to be scooped where lamplight was needed. Yet tuff is strong enough that Turkey considered using these nether cities as bomb shelters had the 1990 Persian Gulf War spread. In the underground city of Derinkuyu, the floor below the stables held fodder bins for livestock. Next down was a communal kitchen, with earthen ovens placed below holes in 9-foot ceilings that, via offset rock tubes, channeled smoke to chimneys 2 kilometers away, so that enemies wouldn't know where they were. For the same reason, ventilation shafts were also engineered on the skew. Copious storage space and thousands of earthenware jars and urns suggest that thousands of people spent months down here without seeing the sun. Through vertical communication shafts, it was possible to speak to another person on any level. Underground wells provided their water. Underground drains prevented flooding. Some water was routed through tuff conduits to underground wineries and breweries equipped with tuff fermentation vats and basalt grinding wheels. These beverages were probably essential for calming the claustrophobia induced by passing between levels via staircases so intentionally low, tight, and serpentine that any invaders had to proceed slowly, bent over, and in single file. Emerging one by one, they would be easily slain, if they got that far. Stairways and ramps had landings every 10 meters, with Stone Age pocket doors, half-ton floor-to-ceiling stone wheels that could be rolled in place to seal a passage. Trapped between a pair of these, intruders would soon notice that holes overhead weren't air shafts, but pipes for bathing them with hot oil. Another 3 floors below this underworld fortress, a room with a vaulted ceiling and benches facing a stone lectern, was a school. Farther below were multiple levels of living quarters, strung along underground streets that branched and intersected for several square kilometers. They included double alcoves for adults with children, and even playrooms featuring pitch-black tunnels that returned to the same spot. And farther, 8 levels down in Derinkuyu, 2 large high-ceiling spaces join in a cruciform. Although, due to constant humidity, no frescoes or paintings remain, in this church, 7th-century Christians who emigrated from Antioch and Palestine would have prayed and hidden from Arab invaders. Below it is a tiny cube-shaped room. It was a temporary tomb, where the dead could be kept until danger passed. As Derinkuyu and the other underground cities passed from hand to hand, and civilization to civilization, their citizens always returned to the surface to bury their own in the soil where food grew under sun and rainfall. The surface was where they were bred to live and die. But one day, when we are long gone, it is the underground cities they built for protection that will defend humanity's memory, bearing final, albeit hidden, witness to the fact that once we were here. Chapter 9. Polymers Are Forever. The port of Plymouth in southwestern England is no longer listed among the scenic towns of the British Isles, although prior to World War II it would have qualified. During 6 nights of March and April 1941, Nazi bombs destroyed 75,000 buildings in what is remembered as the Plymouth Blitz. When the annihilated city center was rebuilt, a modern concrete grid was superimposed on Plymouth's crooked cobbled lanes, burying its medieval past in memory. But the main history of Plymouth lies at its edge, in the natural harbor formed at the confluence of two rivers, the Plym and the Tamar, where they join the English Channel and the Atlantic Ocean. This is the Plymouth from which the Pilgrims departed. They named their American landfall across the sea in its honor. All three of Captain Cook's Pacific expeditions began here, as did Sir Francis Drake's circumnavigation of the globe. And on December 27, 1831, HMS Beagle set sail from Plymouth Harbor with 22-year-old Charles Darwin aboard. University of Plymouth marine biologist Richard Thompson spends a lot of time pacing Plymouth's historic edge. He especially goes in winter, when the beaches along the harbor's estuaries are empty. A tall man in jeans, boots, blue windbreaker, and zippered fleece sweater, his bald pate hatless, his long fingers gloveless, as he bends to probe the sand. Thompson's doctoral study was on slimy stuff that mollusks, such as limpets and winkles, like to eat. Diatoms, cyanobacteria, algae, and tiny plants that cling to seaweed. What he's now known for, however, has less to do with marine life than with the growing presence of things in the ocean that have never been alive at all. Although he didn't realize it at the time, what has dominated his life's work began when he was still an undergraduate in the 1980s, spending autumn weekends organizing the Liverpool contingent of Great Britain's National Beach Cleanup. In his final year, he had 170 teammates amassing metric tons of rubbish along 85 miles of shoreline. Apart from items that apparently had dropped from boats, such as Greek salt boxes and Italian oil cruets, from the labels, he could see that most of the debris was blowing east from Ireland. In turn, Sweden's shores were the receptacles for trash from England. Any packaging that trapped enough air to protrude from the water seemed to obey the wind currents, which in these latitudes are easterly. Smaller, lower-profile fragments, however, were apparently controlled by currents in the water. Each year, as he compiled the team's annual reports, Thompson noticed more and more garbage that was smaller and smaller amid the usual bottles and automobile tires. He and another student began collecting sand samples along beach strand lines. They sieved the tiniest particles of whatever appeared unnatural and tried to identify them under a microscope. This proved tricky. Their subjects were usually too small to allow them to pinpoint the bottles, toys, or appliances from which they sprang. He continued working the annual cleanup during graduate studies at Newcastle. Once he completed his PhD and began teaching at Plymouth, his department acquired a Fourier transform infrared spectrometer, a device that passes a microbeam through a substance, then compares its infrared spectrum to a database of known material. Now he could know what he was looking at, which only deepened his concern. Any idea what these are? Thompson is guiding a visitor along the shore of the Plym River estuary, near where it joins the sea. With a full moonrise just a few hours off, the tide is out nearly 200 meters, exposing a sandy flat scattered with bladder wrack and cockle shells. A breeze skims the tidal pools, shivering rows of reflected hillside housing projects. Thompson bends over the strand line of detritus left by the forward edge of waves lapping the shore, looking for anything recognizable. Hunks of nylon rope, syringes, topless plastic food containers, half a ship's float, pebbled remains of polystyrene packaging, and a rainbow of assorted bottle caps. Most plentiful of all are multicolored plastic shafts of cotton ear swabs. But there are also the odd little uniform shapes he challenges people to identify. Amid twigs and seaweed fibers in his fistful of sand are a couple of dozen blue and green plastic cylinders about 2 millimeters high. They're called nurdles. They're the raw materials of plastic production. They melt these down to make all kinds of things. He walks a little farther, then scoops up another handful. It contains more of the same plastic bits. Pale blue ones, greens, reds, and tans. Each handful, he calculates, is about 20% plastic, and each holds at least 30 pellets. You find these things on virtually every beach these days. Obviously, they are from some factory. However, there is no plastic manufacturing anywhere nearby. The pellets have ridden some current over a great distance until they were deposited here, collected and sized by the wind and tide. In Thompson's laboratory at the University of Plymouth, graduate student Mark Brown unpacks foil-wrapped beach samples that arrive in clear Ziploc bags sent by an international network of colleagues. He transfers these to a glass-separating funnel filled with a concentrated solution of sea salt to float off the plastic particles. He filters out what he thinks he recognizes, such as pieces of the ubiquitous colored ear swab shafts, to check under the microscope. Anything really unusual goes to the FTIR spectrometer. Each takes more than an hour to identify. About one-third turn out to be natural fibers such as seaweed. Another third are plastic. And another third are unknown, meaning that they haven't found a match in their polymer database, or that the particle has been in the water so long its color has degraded, or that it's too small for their machine, which analyzes fragments only to 20 microns, slightly thinner than a human hair. That means we're underestimating the amount of plastic that we're finding. The true answer is, we just don't know how much is out there. What they do know is that there's much more than ever before. During the early 20th century, Plymouth marine biologist Alistair Hardy developed an apparatus that could be towed behind an Antarctic expedition boat 10 meters below the surface, to sample krill, an ant-sized shrimp-like invertebrate on which much of the planet's food chain rests. In the 1930s, he modified it to measure even smaller plankton. It employed an impeller to turn a moving band of silk, similar to how a dispenser in a public lavatory moves cloth towels. As the silk passed over an opening, it filtered plankton from water passing through it. Each band of silk had a sampling capacity of 500 nautical miles. Hardy was able to convince English merchant vessels using commercial shipping lanes throughout the North Atlantic to drag his continuous plankton recorder for several decades, amassing a database so valuable, he was eventually knighted for his contributions to marine science. He took so many samples around the British Isles that only every second one was analyzed. Decades later, Richard Thompson realized that the ones that remained stored in a climate-controlled Plymouth warehouse were a time capsule containing a record of growing contamination. He picked two routes out of northern Scotland that had been sampled regularly, one to Iceland, one to the Shetland Islands. His team pored over rolls of silk reeking of chemical preservative, looking for old plastic. There was no reason to examine years prior to World War II, because until then, plastic barely existed, except for the bakelite used in telephones and radios, appliances so durable they had yet to enter the waste chain. Disposable plastic packaging hadn't yet been invented. By the 1960s, however, they were seeing increasing numbers of increasing kinds of plastic particles. By the 1990s, the samples were flecked with triple the amount of acrylic, polyester, and crumbs of other synthetic polymers than was present three decades earlier. Especially troubling was that Hardy's plankton recorder had trapped all this plastic 10 meters below the surface, suspended in the water. Since plastic mostly floats, that meant they were seeing just a fraction of what was actually there. Not only was the amount of plastic in the ocean increasing, but ever smaller bits of it were appearing, small enough to ride global sea currents. Thompson's team realized that slow mechanical action, waves and tides that grind against shorelines, turning rocks into beaches, were now doing the same to plastics. The largest, most conspicuous items bobbing in the surf were slowly getting smaller. At the same time, There was no sign that any of the plastic was biodegrading, even when reduced to tiny fragments. We imagined it was being ground down smaller and smaller into a kind of powder, and we realized that smaller and smaller could lead to bigger and bigger problems. He knew the terrible tales of sea otters choking on polyethylene rings from beer six-packs, of swans and gulls strangled by nylon nets and fishing lines, of a green sea turtle in Hawaii dead with a pocket comb, a foot of nylon rope, and a toy truck wheel lodged in its gut. His personal worst was a study on fulmar carcasses washed ashore on North Sea coastlines. 95% had plastic in their stomachs, an average of 44 pieces per bird. A proportional amount in a human being would weigh nearly 5 pounds. There was no way of knowing if the plastic had killed them, although it was a safe bet that, in many, chunks of indigestible plastic had blocked their intestines. Thompson reasoned that if larger plastic pieces were breaking down into smaller particles, smaller organisms would likely be consuming them. He devised an aquarium experiment, using bottom-feeding lugworms that live on organic sediments, barnacles that filter organic matter suspended in water, and sand fleas that eat beach detritus. In the experiment, plastic particles and fibers were provided in proportionately bite-sized quantities. Each creature promptly ingested them. When the particles lodged in their intestines, the resulting constipation was terminal. If they were small enough, they passed through the invertebrates' digestive tracts and emerged, seemingly harmlessly, out the other end. Did that mean that plastics were so stable that they weren't toxic? At what point would they start to naturally break down? And when they did, would they release some fearful chemicals that would endanger organisms sometime far in the future? Richard Thompson didn't know. Nobody did, because plastics haven't been around long enough for us to know how long they'll last or what happens to them. His team had identified 9 different kinds in the sea so far. Varieties of acrylic, nylon, polyester, polyethylene, polypropylene, and polyvinyl chloride. All he knew was that soon everything alive would be eating them. When they get as small as powder, even zooplankton will swallow them. 2 sources of tiny plastic particles hadn't before occurred to Thompson. Plastic bags clog everything from sewer drains to the gullets of sea turtles who mistake them for jellyfish. Increasingly, purportedly biodegradable versions were available. Thompson's team tried them. Most turned out to be just a mixture of cellulose and polymers. After the cellulose starch broke down, thousands of clear, nearly invisible plastic particles remained. Some bags were advertised to degrade in compost piles, as heat generated by decaying organic garbage rises past 100 degrees Fahrenheit. Maybe they do, but that doesn't happen on a beach or in salt water. He'd learned that after they tied plastic produce bags to moorings in Plymouth Harbor. A year later, you could still carry groceries in them. Even more exasperating was what his PhD student Mark Brown discovered while shopping in a pharmacy. Brown pulls open the top drawer of a laboratory cabinet. Inside is a feminine cornucopia of beauty aids. Shower massage creams, body scrubs, and hand cleaners. Several are by boutique labels. Neova Body Smoother, SkinCeuticals Body Polish, and DDF Strawberry Almond Body Polish. Others are international name brands. Pond's Fresh Start, a tube of Colgate Icy Blast Toothpaste, Neutrogena, Clearasil. Some are available in the United States, others only in the United Kingdom. But all have one thing in common. Exfoliants, little granules that massage you as you bathe. He selects a peach-colored tube of St. Ives Apricot Scrub. Its label reads, 100% natural exfoliants. This stuff is okay. The granules are actually chunks of ground-up jojoba seeds and walnut shells. Other natural brands use grape seeds, apricot hulls, coarse sugar, or sea salt. The rest of them, he says with a sweep of his hand, have all gone to plastic. On each, listed among the ingredients, are microfine polyethylene granules, or polyethylene microspheres, or polyethylene beads, or just polyethylene. Can you believe it? Richard Thompson demands of no one in particular, loud enough that faces bent over microscopes rise to look at him. They're selling plastic meant to go right down the drain, into the sewers, into the rivers, right into the ocean. Bite-sized pieces of plastic to be swallowed by little sea creatures. Plastic bits are also increasingly used to scour paint from boats and aircraft. Thompson shudders. One wonders where plastic beads laden with paint are disposed. It would be difficult to contain them on a windy day. But even if they are contained, there's no filter in any sewage works for material that small. It's inevitable. They end up in the environment. He peers into Brown's microscope at a sample from Finland. A lone green fiber, probably from a plant, lies across three bright blue threads that probably aren't. He perches on the countertop, hooking his hiking boots across a lab stool. Think of it this way. Suppose all human activity ceased tomorrow, and suddenly there's no one to produce plastic anymore. Just from what's already present, given how we see it fragmenting, organisms will be dealing with this stuff indefinitely. Thousands of years, possibly, or more. In one sense, plastics have been around for millions of years. Plastics are polymers, simple molecular configurations of carbon and hydrogen atoms that link together repeatedly to form chains. Spiders have been spinning polymer fibers called silk since before the Carboniferous Age, whereupon trees appeared and started making cellulose and lignin, also natural polymers. Cotton and rubber are polymers. And we make the stuff ourselves, too, in the form of collagen that comprises, among other things, our fingernails. Another natural moldable polymer that closely fits our idea of plastics is the secretion from an Asian scale beetle that we know as shellac. It was the search for an artificial shellac substitute that one day led chemist Leo Baekeland to mix tarry carbolic acid, phenol, with formaldehyde in his garage in Yonkers, New York. Until then, shellac was the only coating available for electric wires and connections. The moldable result became Bakelite. Bakeland became very wealthy, and the world became a very different place. Chemists were soon busy cracking long hydrocarbon chain molecules of crude petroleum into smaller ones, and mixing these fractionates to see what variations on Bakelin's first man-made plastic they could produce. Adding chlorine yielded a strong, hardy polymer unlike anything in nature, known today as PVC. Blowing gas into another polymer as it formed created tough, linked bubbles called polystyrene, often known by the brand name Styrofoam. And the continual quest for an artificial silk led to nylon. Sheer nylon stockings revolutionized the apparel industry and helped to drive acceptance of plastic as a defining achievement of modern life. The intercession of World War II, which diverted most nylon and plastic to the war effort, only made people desire them more. After 1945, a torrent of products the world had never seen roared into general consumption. Acrylic textiles, plexiglass, polyethylene bottles, polypropylene containers, and foam rubber polyurethane toys. Most world-changing of all was transparent packaging, including self-clinging wraps of polyvinyl chloride and polyethylene, which let us see the foods wrapped inside them and keep them preserved longer than ever before. Within 10 years, the downside to this wonder substance was apparent. Life magazine coined the term throwaway society, though the idea of tossing trash was hardly new. Humans had done that from the beginning, with leftover bones from their hunt and chaff from their harvest, whereupon other organisms took over. When manufactured goods entered the garbage stream, they were at first considered less offensive than smelly organic wastes. Broken bricks and pottery became the fill for the buildings of subsequent generations. Discarded clothing reappeared in secondary markets run by ragmen, or were recycled into new fabric. Defunct machines that accumulated in junkyards could be mined for parts, or alchemized into new inventions. Hunks of metal could simply be melted down into something totally different. World War II, at least the Japanese naval and air portion, was literally constructed out of American scrap heaps. Stanford archaeologist William Rachi, who has made a career of studying garbage in America, finds himself continually disabusing waste management officials and the general public of what he deems a myth, that plastic is responsible for overflowing landfills across the country. Rachi's decades-long garbage project, wherein students weighed and measured weeks' worth of residential waste, reported during the 1980s that, contrary to popular belief, plastic accounts for less than 20% by volume of buried wastes, in part because it can be compressed more tightly than other refuse. Although increasingly higher percentages of plastic items have been produced since then, Rachi doesn't expect the proportions to change, because improved manufacturing uses less plastic per soda bottle or disposable wrapper. The bulk of what's in landfills, he says, is construction debris and paper products. Newspapers, he claims, again belying a common assumption, don't biodegrade when buried away from air and water. That's why we have 3,000-year-old papyrus scrolls from Egypt. We pull perfectly readable newspapers out of landfills from the 1930s. They'll be down there for 10,000 years. He agrees, though, that plastic embodies our collective guilt over trashing the environment. Something about plastic feels uneasily permanent. The difference may have to do with what happens outside landfills, where a newspaper gets shredded by wind, cracks in sunlight, and dissolves in rain, if it doesn't burn first. What happens to plastic, however, is seen most vividly where trash is never collected. Humans have continuously inhabited the Hopi Indian Reservation in northern Arizona since AD 1000, longer than any other site in today's United States. The principal Hopi villages sit atop three mesas with 360-degree views of the surrounding desert. For centuries, the Hopis simply threw their garbage, consisting of food scraps and broken ceramic, over the sides of the mesas. Coyotes and vultures took care of the food wastes, and the pottery shards blended back into the ground they came from. That worked fine until the mid-20th century. Then the garbage tossed over the side stopped going away. The Hopis were visibly surrounded by a rising pile of a new, nature-proof kind of trash. The only way it disappeared was by being blown across the desert. But it was still there, stuck to sage and mesquite branches, impaled on cactus spines. South of the Hopi Mesas rise the 12,500-foot San Francisco Peaks, home to Hopi and Navajo gods who dwell among aspens and Douglas firs. Holy mountains, cloaked in purifying white each winter, except in recent years, because snow now rarely falls. In this age of deepening drought and rising temperatures, ski lift operators, who the Indians claim defile sacred ground with their clanking machines and lucre, are being sued anew. Their latest desecration is making artificial snow for their ski runs from wastewater, which the Indians likened to bathing the face of God in shit. East of the San Francisco Peaks are the even taller Rockies. To their west are the Sierra Madres, whose volcanic summits are higher still. Impossible as it is for us to fathom, all these colossal mountains will one day erode to the sea. Every boulder, outcrop, saddle, spire, and canyon wall. Every massive uplift will pulverize, their minerals dissolving to keep the ocean salted, the plume of nutrients in their soil nourishing a new marine biological age, even as the previous one disappears beneath their sediments. Long before that, however, these deposits will have been preceded by a substance far lighter and more easily carried seaward than rocks or even grains of silt. Captain Charles Moore of Long Beach, California, learned that the day in 1997, when sailing out of Honolulu, he steered his aluminum-hulled catamaran into a part of the Western Pacific he'd always avoided. Sometimes known as the horse latitude,